Today I'm going to be talking about the First World War, the war of 1914 to 1918. Okay. And you may say, what does this have to do with international politics? In the old days, the study of international politics essentially stopped when wars broke out. The whole idea was that previous story where the diplomats, the foreign offices, and so on held center stage, that was over. The baton had now been passed to the generals, away from a political process to a military process. War breaks out, it gets fought till one side or the other wins, end of story. When you think about it, it can't be that simple. There can't be such a sharp dividing line between war and peace. Right? Why? Because wars don't just come into being as a result of a force of nature. They're a human artifact. They break out for political reasons because there are political conflicts. They're fought for political purposes. This is the great insight, the central insight of what's by far the most important book on war. It's called On War by the German general Karl von Clausewitz in the early 19th century. The basic insight of Clausewitz is that war is a continuation of politics. War is for political goals. It's not just, you know, something that happens because people want to kill each other. Okay? So there has to be a continuation of the political story. What goes on when a war is being fought in the political sphere, you would think, is of fundamental importance, because every war must end, to use the title of another famous book on this subject by Freddie Clay. Every war must end. There has to be some political settlement. It's not like wars are fought until the very last drop of energy is squeezed out of a population, and war is fought to the bitter end with people, you know, just being wiped out until there's absolutely no resistance whatsoever. Okay? This is what makes the First World War so puzzling when you look at it in a political perspective. Why? What's the puzzle of the First World War? It's that there's a military stalemate, especially in the Western Front. And you would expect this. You know, here you have two blocks of approximately equal power, the Central Powers and the Triple Entente. There's a great myth that everyone believed that the war would be over quickly. Not true. As a matter of fact, there's some of the most important historical work on this stuff that's been done in the past 20, 30 years has shown that certainly for the German general staff, it was not anticipated that the war would be over in a matter of weeks. They anticipated a fairly long struggle. And this view was shared by a lot of people. There's a famous remark from the British Foreign Secretary in 1914, Sir Edward Grey, about the lamps are going out all over Europe. We will not see them lit again in our lifetime. Okay? And sure enough, that's what happened. The Schlieffen Plan is put into effect. This is the Germany's hope for victory. And the German armies move through Belgium into northern France, but the German advance is stopped by the French after the Germans have occupied a great area in northern France. And quickly, the struggle settles down into a long war of attrition as each side digs itself in. See, this is one of the big ironies. The militaries in Europe, all these militaries, had emphasized rapid offensive action. And yet the war itself showed that the defense was dominant. It was very hard to kind of move and conquer territory occupied by the enemy, to break through enemy lines and so on. You all know the images of the First World War. Each side digs these huge trenches, you know, systems of trenches going from the Swiss border straight through to the English Channel, you know. And arm themselves with machine guns. They throw up all these barbed wire obstacles, making it very difficult for the enemy to launch an offensive. The enemy forces, if they tried to break through, they would just be wiped out by machine gun fire, right? And this is true for both sides. You have a military stalemate because the defense is so strong on both sides. In the East, there's more fluidity, but still, given the fact that the struggle in the West is the fundamental struggle of the First World War between Germany on one hand and Britain and France on the other, the Germans don't have enough to really divert to the East to kind of reach a decision, enough to kind of keep the Russians from winning, but not enough to reach a decision in the East, although Russia drops out of the war as a result of the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, October 1917. Okay. The struggle in the West, the military stalemate in the West, that's of fundamental importance. Now, why is this puzzling from our point of view? Well, what would you expect politically when it became clear that both sides were bogged down in a situation of the sort, when neither side could hope to achieve, a military breakthrough and military victory? Well, what would you expect? You'd expect they negotiate. You'd expect a compromise peace, right? Because the continuation of the military effort wasn't getting either side anyplace. That's what you would expect. And yet you don't have it. You know, in Churchill's phrase, Winston Churchill, who was high up in the British government in 1914, he was also a historian, and he wrote a book on the First World War. He says, "The fires raged until they burned themselves out." There was no political process that led to a negotiated settlement of any meaningful sort. Now that's puzzling from a historical point of view, but it's also puzzling from a theoretical point of view. There's a famous book he's an Australian historian named Geoffrey Blainey, called The Causes of War. And Blainey made this argument about why wars break out and why wars get settled and why a stable peace takes shape. Blainey says, wars break out because of a difference of opinion about what the military balance is. You know, each side thinks it's going to win. But both sides can't be right. That can't correspond to reality. People don't know what the reality is until the fighting actually begins. The war itself reveals information. It reveals what the true military balance is. And so the revealing of information about the military balance should lead each side to adjust its political goals so as to reach a settlement. One side or the other wins. The side that wins, that's the side that's strongest, and the political sentiment will reflect that fact. All right? That's the Blainey argument. And that argument was taken up and developed in very important ways by a political scientist named James Fearon. Okay. He wrote an article called Rationalist Explanations for War. It's probably the single most important article in international relations theory written over the last 40 years or so. And Fearon says, countries normally should be able to strike a deal, to make a bargain with each other to avoid the costs of war. Yeah. If both sides knew how the war would end, they could save themselves a lot of trouble, if only by agreeing on the sort of settlement that was reached at the end of the war, following the war. And each side would be in a better position if they simply agreed on that settlement then, and if they fought the war, because each side would spare itself the costs of the war. So war is never an efficient way of settling political disputes. So why is it then that that war is fought? And Fearon said, well, you can interpret these things in irrational terms, but if you're a rationalist, and the rationalist perspective is very powerful as an engine of insight, if you're a rationalist, he says, basically, there has to be some sort of information problem. One side can have has to have information that the other side doesn't have about what the military balance actually is. And again, it's very much aligned with the Blaney argument. The war itself clears up that information problem. It should lead to a peaceful settlement. And it's puzzling if it doesn't. Right? So it's a puzzle from that perspective. It's also puzzling, take a somewhat different theoretical perspective, from a realist view, realism being the central tradition of international relations theory, a theory that emphasizes the importance of power considerations, security considerations in international politics. One of the tenets of the realist theory is that there are enormous incentives for countries to behave rationally in power political terms. You'd expect rational behavior in power political terms. You'd expect countries to pursue policies based on their own interests defined in power political terms, what gives states a power political advantage. And you look at countries like France and especially Britain. Do they really have an interest in defeating Germany so totally that German power is absolutely crushed and Germany becomes a cipher in the European balance of power? So, from the standpoint of Britain and France, no, that's not to their interest. Why? Because to crush Germany like that would mean that there's no counterweight to Russian power in Europe. Here we have this Russian colossus. You know, building up its power left and right, huge territory, huge population. If you destroy Germany, what's going to be the counterweight to Russia? You're going to have a Europe dominated by Russia. So if you have countries like Britain and France, they're essentially status quo powers. They have these huge empires. All they want is their own security, well, especially Britain. You'd expect that what they would want is a peace settlement that leaves German power somewhat intact, that makes sure that Germany and Russia are able to balance each other so that neither of those countries can dominate Europe. So you'd expect, not because they have some sort of abstract commitment to the balance of power theory, but simply in pursuit of their own interests, that they would push toward a negotiated settlement. Compromise peace, a peace among equals. Okay? And yet it doesn't happen. What's so striking about this story is that political considerations of that sort ignored by everybody. What's striking about this story is that the goal is not to achieve a compromise peace. The goal is to achieve victory. The goal is to win. The goal is to crush the adversary as an end in itself. You know, it's like the basic insights of Clausewitz pushed to the side. The sort of policy that you associate with realism, with power politics, you just don't see it there. Right? The goal was to win. You want to read something really nice about this? There's a book called Strategy in the Missile Age. It came out in 1959. It was written by Bernard Brody, who was one of the leading strategic thinkers of the nuclear age. And he was actually a member of our own department, probably the most distinguished member of the UCLA Political Science Department ever. And Brody has his first chapter in that book, which is about nuclear issues. He talks about the First World War. He talks about how absurd it was that the aim was to win. That's not an aim. How absurd it was that they didn't reach a compromise peace. Right? How power political considerations would not put in the forefront of policy. And his point is that this same sort of thing can happen again. You know, if we think of military strategy simply in those kind of apolitical terms, that the goal is simply military victory, end of story, you know, we could be heading toward disaster. Just as the world had this disastrous First World War that was not ended by a political reconciliation, political settlement. How is all this to be explained? Some people think, well, a lot of the explanation of void behavior is not to be understood in rational terms. It has to do with regime type. You know, it's like, you'll look at a regime like Imperial Germany. You know, how here you have a narrow pre-industrial section of the population, the landowning classes in the east of Germany, what they call Junkers, the Junker elite, kind of a feudal survival. These people retain control of the German state, but they need to get the support. In order to maintain their power within Germany, they have to kind of play these chauvinistic chords and appeal to the chauvinistic tendencies of the population in order to kind of mobilize support for themselves and to kind of guarantee their position within Germany. You know, there's this notion that for domestic political reasons within Germany having to do with the peculiar nature of the German state, Germany was led to pursue this annexationist policy, and if Germany was pursuing that, then there's no chance for a compromise peace, right? And it's true enough that Germany had an annexationist policy during the First World War. Does that mean that regime type was of fundamental importance? Answer, no, because all of the belligerents pursued annexationist policies. All of the belligerents have this whole notion of the enemy has to be crushed, the enemy has to be totally defeated. After the Second World War, there was a certain attempt to kind of play this down. The leading French diplomatic historian of that generation, his name is Pierre Renouvin. He was very interested in Franco-German reconciliation, and his whole feeling was both sides should kind of play down their aggressive intentions vis-a-vis the other. And he wrote an article on French war aims in which he basically said that French war aims during the First World War period were purely defensive. And then, you know, years later, another much younger French historian named Georges Soutou wrote a piece in which he basically showed that that whole Renouvin article just, you know, missed the point. In fact, the French had a very annexationist program. It was all, they had a code term, guarantees. We need guarantees against a renewal of German aggression. Guarantees meant that the whole area of the Rhineland would be placed under either direct or indirect French control. And the French negotiated with their allies, and especially with the Russians, so that each would support the other's annexationist goals. Right? The Tsar told a French leader in 1916, he says, take Mainz, take Koblenz, you know, two major cities in the Rhineland within Germany. You know, go further still if you judge it useful. And the Western allies, for their part, also supported Russian expansionist goals, above all, the Russian occupation of the Turkish Straits, something which they had not supported before the war. Right? It's not regime type, because you find the same phenomenon regardless of what belligerent you look at. We're talking about the United States in a little while along these lines. So what is it? I mean, it really is puzzling. And all you could do is kind of speculate a little. And even the speculation doesn't quite come toward adequately accounting for what you see, or more accurately, what you don't see when you look at the story of the First World War. It's like, well, here you have this enormous bloodletting in the First World War. And governments can't turn to their own people and say, oh, well, it was just to get back to where we started from in 1914. you had to explain to them why these huge sacrifices were warranted by escalating your goals in the war. It's going to be the war to end war. It's going to be, you know, lead to a dramatically different world. And then there were tactical considerations. You know, what if governments started talking about, well, we have to kind of draw in our horns, we need to kind of think in terms of compromise, or, you know, this war isn't worth it. Well, that's defeatist talk, and it gives the enemy an advantage. It weakens morale on the home front. You can't do that. And then there's this kind of inter-allied dynamic. You know, you're terribly concerned about losing your allies. You know, the allies defecting, making a separate peace. And so in order to keep the allies in the war, you have to kind of support their annexationist policies. And they affected by the same dynamic, they'll support your policies. I mean, you can think about, you know, dynamics of that story. It's, you know, it goes in certain ways toward accounting for what happened, but it's still profoundly puzzling.
Okay.
So there's no political solution, no negotiated settlement, no attempt at one, because both sides have such far-reaching political goals that a settlement is not within reach. So if there is not going to be a political settlement to the war, what sort of strategies do the governments adopt? The war is going to be ended with the victory of one side and the defeat of the other. There are two sorts of strategies that are pursued, one military, the other political. In the military sphere, there's this great hunger for something that will dramatically affect the fighting on the battlefield. In tactical terms, there has to be some sort of answer to the military stalemate produced by these defensive measures that both sides have taken, the trenches, the barbed wire, and the machine guns, and so on. And what's the answer there? Well, a number of answers, but the main answer is the tank, an armored vehicle, which would enable you to kind of go through enemy lines and restore a certain degree of movement to the war. What's very interesting here is that the military resists the tank. It's imposed on them by civilian authorities. And the tank is not a huge, you know, technological breakthrough, because basically it's simply a question of using the technology developed for agricultural purposes with the Caterpillar tractor, and then giving the tractor a defensive and offensive armament. And when the tanks are introduced, it does have a certain effect in terms of restoring a degree of mobility to the war, moving away from a war of attrition. Poison gas, that's another one. Poison gas was used very widely in the First World War to kind of get a military advantage. You know, an indirect strategy of kind of looking through for breakthroughs in more vulnerable theaters, like especially around the Turkish Straits and in the East in general. None of these tactics really worked. The Germans developed various tactics, the use of shock troops in 1918 to try and reach a military decision in the West. Tactical success, but strategic terms, it's a failure. Okay. None of these things work. Well, then there's also the political strategy of this. If this is a war of attrition, it's going to be determined by resources. You need new resources, fresh resources, because your own resources are being depleted by the bloodletting. And so there's a great attempt to bring in allies, to recruit allies to your effort. And so the diplomacy of the war focuses on acquiring allies. And both sides have a certain success in this. In 1915, Italy, which in 1914 had been the ally of Germany and Austria, comes into the war on the side of the Entente. Italy is basically bribed into entering the war on the Entente side. Italy is not terribly impressive in military terms. It doesn't have a dramatic effect on the battlefield. Similarly, Romania comes into the war on the side of the Entente. Bulgaria on the side of the Central Powers. Turkey on the side of the Central Powers. The spread of the war to draw in these European neutrals does not result in a military decision. But there's one great neutral power whose entry into the war can, in theory, tip the balance, and in practice did, in fact, prove decisive. What neutral power is that? The United States of America, which by this point is by far the most powerful country in the world in terms of its war-making potential, not forces in being, because the United States did not develop a large army during the years of peace before 1914. Why should it? Security was protected by the British. The British weren't going to be able to threaten the United States. British naval power wasn't a problem for us. We had weak neighbors to the north and the south, these huge oceans to the east and west. America was a very secure country. So why squander resources in the development of a large standing army? Right? So America didn't have much in terms of forces in being, but when you look at the figures for steel production, I put some of these figures in one of the tables in the maps and tables section at the course website. You can look at the stuff if you like. Steel production, America is by far the most powerful country in the world. Steel production practically equal to that of all the European countries put together. You know, and steel production is the crucial index of military potential, because the kind of military technology you have at the time is based essentially on steel. When you think of all the things that are, all the kinds of armaments that were produced at that time, you know, steel is of crucial importance. Right? America intervenes in the war April 1917, but the American intervention is not effective until 1918, because it takes such a long time to recruit an army, to train an army, to transport it to the battlefields, to arm it with the proper equipment and so on. So it's not until 1918 that American power becomes fully effective. Still, everyone knows that American involvement, for all these fresh resources thrown into the military balance, is going to have a very fundamental effect. Why did the United States intervene in the war? Okay. This is of fundamental importance. What are we to make of American policy, the policy the United States pursued that led to American intervention in the war? Okay. People say, oh, well, Wilson, President Woodrow Wilson, you know, the maker of American policy at that time, essentially, he didn't have any choice. America intervened in the war because the Germans had renewed the submarine war against shipping that was supplying the Western Allies. Okay. It's not as simple as that. Okay. U.S. policy was not based on a kind of mindless defense of America's rights as a neutral to trade with whichever belligerent she wanted. America had a policy of neutrality, but it wasn't genuinely neutral. There were people high up in the American government who wanted to pursue a neutral policy, most notably Wilson's first Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan. But Bryan was fired by Wilson because he wanted to pursue a more rigorous policy of neutrality than Wilson thought was appropriate. Why was American policy not neutral? The answer here is that the Americans claimed the right to trade with both belligerents, you know, with the exception of what was called contraband of war, material that was very directly related to the military struggle, but food and, you know, all kinds of civilian trade was supposed to be okay. But when the British interfered with the shipment of goods to Germany, not just the German ports directly in American ships, but through shipments to the European neutrals that had a common border with Germany, especially Holland, also, you know, Denmark. The British were unwilling to allow the United States goods to get to Germany in any way. The British were violating the what were then considered the accepted rules of naval warfare, of blockade. Incidentally, I should say that there was some very interesting historical work that was done on this. There's a guy named Avner Offer, O-F-F-E-R, who wrote a book called The First World War, An Agrarian Interpretation. And Offer was very interested in all the stuff relating to blockade, you know, because in 1908, there was something called the Declaration of London that was supposed to regulate naval warfare in the event of a big war like this. Blockade was supposed to be fairly limited in terms of what could be forbidden. Turns out the British went along with this arrangement with every intention of violating it in the event of war. And in a sense, they had to violate it, because what's the good of having a big navy that controls the seas if you can't use that navy to blockade your enemy, to starve out your enemy in the event of war? So British naval power, which is the principal instrument of British power for most of the time, was to be made into a cipher and neutralized. You know, you couldn't say that an American policy that insisted that the British Navy be of no account would have been a neutral policy. Anyway, the Americans accept the British blockade of Germany. There's a lot of legalistic talk about, you know, we don't like it and this and that, but we're not willing to do anything about it. We're not willing to threaten the British that if you don't allow us to trade with Germany, we're not going to trade with you either. In which case, the British would have had to give way and America could have traded with both sides. Right? That's not the U.S. policy. The U.S. policy allows the British blockade of Germany to continue, whereas American ships have the right to kind of trade with Britain and France. Not a neutral policy. Not just that, but the British, the Western Allies in general, they are allowed to finance their imports with loans that they raise in the American money market. Yeah, there's a lot of uneasiness about this because the feeling is it's not a neutral policy. So how do you explain American policy? Now, not a mindless defense of neutral rights. If the outcome of the war were a matter of utter indifference to the United States, it's inconceivable that the Americans would have pursued the policy that they did, a policy which had the effect of, at least on the surface, of drawing us into the war. On the other hand, this is not a straightforward balance of power policy either. Right? Yes, the Americans kind of vaguely understand that a defeat of Britain and France would prejudice American security, a German-dominated Europe is not something we view with relish by any means. But those security considerations, balance of power considerations, they are not in the driver's seat either. Okay. What is American policy? The more you kind of get into it, the clearer it is that the Wilson government didn't really have a clear strategy, a clear sense of what it wanted to accomplish. American policy is kind of drifting, shaped by kind of somewhat conflicting goals that are not really worked out. In principle, the Americans want to end the war. They want to use their power to bring about a negotiated peace. The key piece of evidence here is a very famous speech that Wilson gave a few months before the United States entered the war. This is called the Peace Without Victory Speech, January of 1917. And listen to the tone of the speech. And Wilson's calling for a peace without victory. A compromise peace, a negotiated peace. He says, victory would mean peace forced upon the loser. A victor's peace imposed upon the vanquished. It would be accepted in humiliation, under duress, at an intolerable sacrifice, and would leave a sting, a resentment, a bitter memory upon which terms of peace would rest, not permanently, but only as upon quicksand. Only a peace between equals can last. Only a peace, the very principle of which is equality and a common participation in a common benefit. The right state of mind, the right feeling between nations is as necessary for a lasting peace as is the just settlement of vexed questions of territory or of racial and national allegiance. It's before the United States goes into the war, just a few months before the Americans enter the war. What's America's attitude? As soon as we enter the war? Well, the very first of the Wilson speeches that I asked you to read in the course pack was a speech he gave in December of 1917. And listen to how different the tone is from the Peace Without Victory speech. He talked about how the American people desired peace by the overcoming of evil, by the defeat once and for all of the sinister forces that interrupt peace and render it impossible. And they wish to know how closely our thought runs with theirs and what action we propose. They are impatient with those who desire peace by any sort of compromise, deeply and indignantly impatient. But they will be equally impatient with us if we do not make it plain to them what our objectives are and what we are planning for and seeking to make conquest by peace of arms. And then he says, I believe that I speak for them when I say two things. First, that this intolerable thing, capital T, of which the masters of Germany have shown us the ugly face, this menace of combined intrigue and force, which we now see so clearly as the German power, a thing without conscience or honor or capacity for covenanted peace, must be crushed. And if it be not totally brought to an end, at least shut out from the friendly intercourse of the nations. It's like, this is not peace without victory anymore. This is, we got to crush them. It's like, how do you account for the change? Again, we're not talking about some sort of autocracy that's led for domestic political reasons to opt for such a hard line. This is the premier democratic power in the world. This is the Woodrow Wilson, the great champion of democracy, speaking along these lines. How do you explain it? It's rooted in a certain concept of international politics. See, normally, you know, the United States doesn't want to deal with these kind of sordid power political manipulations of these European countries. So we want to keep apart. But every now and then, the issues become so clear-cut, the moral issues become so black and white, that we got to intervene. And when we do intervene, we intervene, you know, without stint. We want to totally crush the source of evil. Because the only reason we came into the war was that it became clear that we're dealing with evil, right? That's the philosophy. And one of the great questions you have to wrestle with in a course like this is whether that philosophy, the Wilsonian philosophy, the philosophy that foreign policy should be based on moral considerations, not on these kind of political considerations having to do with power and so on, but on what's right and what's wrong, whether that should be at the center. Now, I asked you for this week to read this article. Actually, there's a lecture that George Kennan gave on American intervention in the First World War. Kennan is like one of the great international relations thinkers, not an academic. He was in the policy world. And he laid out a certain philosophy of how of foreign policy and international politics in the series of lectures. Published, I think, in 1950 or 51. And it's one lecture on the First World War. Well, I have to say, it made an enormous impression on me when I when I first read it when I was an undergraduate, because it basically lays out an alternative to the Wilson philosophy. See, his whole argument is that the Wilson philosophy, this is not the sort of approach we should take. This approach of, you know, ignore power considerations, political considerations, think in moral terms. This, you know, this is the road to disaster to embrace that sort of thing. And he develops this argument by giving, you know, a certain analysis of American intervention in the First World War and what its consequences were. Okay. And, you know, he pointed out this dramatic shift in the United States from peace without victory, we don't want to get involved in Europe, it's all too sordid for us, it's all such foolish stuff that we don't sully ourselves by involvement in it, to this whole notion of, you know, the war is a crusade, the enemy has to be crushed, you know, we have to pursue the most far-reaching goals and so on. A dramatic shift like that, a huge throwing of the switches like that, he says it doesn't make any sense. You know, he says it's surely a curious characteristic of democracy, he writes, this amazing ability to shift gears overnight in one's ideological attitudes, depending on whether one considers oneself at war or at peace. Day before yesterday, let's say, the issues at stake between ourselves and another power were not worth the life of a single American boy. Today, nothing else counts at all. Our cause is holy. The cost is no consideration. Violence must know no limitation short of unconditional surrender. And then he goes on to say, you know, this is kind of crazy. He says, I sometimes wonder whether in this respect the democracy is not uncomfortably similar to one of those prehistoric monsters with a body as long as this room and a brain the size of a pea. He lies there in his comfortable primeval mud and pays little attention to his environment. He's slow to wrath. In fact, you practically have to whack his tail off to make him aware that his interests are being disturbed. But once he grasps this, he lays about him with such blind determination that he not only destroys his adversary, but largely wrecks his native habitat. You see, Kennan's, he's talking about the First World War, but he's thinking about the nuclear age and the way we're dealing with the problems in the nuclear age. And he says, you know, then he says, he doesn't leave it, it's just a critique. This is just the basis for proposing an alternative. He says, is there an alternative way of looking at things? He says, well, yeah, I think there is. And the alternative is, you should be aware of the fact that what goes on in Europe is not some sort of trivial, sordid sort of thing that shouldn't interest you at all. It's of fundamental importance because American security depends on what happens in Europe. And therefore, we should be involved. And we should use our power in a way to achieve our fundamental interest, which is the restoration of a balance of power in Europe by means of a compromise peace. That's the course you should take. And then he talks in that vein about what could have and should have been done and the problems of not doing that. And he says, I know people are going to object. People are going to say, well, you're ignoring one fundamental fact, which is that America is a democracy. And you're saying that America should behave in this kind of sophisticated way that thinks in terms of the balance of power, that doesn't take these kind of absolutist moral views, that is willing to use its power for kind of political purposes, to kind of manipulate the behavior of both sides in order to pursue a policy based on its own interests, defined in power political terms, in terms of American security and so on. The American people won't stand for that. The American people think in moral terms. That's what they expect of their leaders. Right? And Kennan says, I'm not even going to quarrel with this. I agree with it. I'm going to concede this point. This is what he says at the end of the piece. And then he kind of concludes by saying, but you can't just leave it at that. He says, If you say that mistakes of the past were unavoidable because of our domestic predilections and habits of thought, you're saying that what stopped us from being more effective than we were was democracy as practiced in our country. If that's true, let's recognize it and measure the full seriousness and find something to do about it. A nation which excuses its own failures by the sacred untouchableness of its own habits can excuse itself into total disaster. Right? That's the lesson for Kennan of the Wilson period. Right? It's a lesson that he wants to apply to the nuclear age. And I've said this a number of times in this class. The reason a lot of these historical interpretations are important is not just that we want to get the history straight. Historical analysis is a vehicle for getting at these fundamental questions of what makes for good policy, what determines whether you have a stable system or not, what makes for war, and so on. Right? Kennan's writing about World War I, but he's thinking of the nuclear age. Okay. All right. So what happens? Yes, the Americans come in. American intervention proves to be decisive. The three Western democracies win the war. They win the war despite the fact that there's a revolution in Russia in late 1917 that takes Russia out of the war. Meaning that the two autocratic powers, Tsarist Russia and Imperial Germany, they're both defeated. The three great Western democracies, Britain, France, and the United States, they win. Germany's defeated so thoroughly that Germany has no choice but to accept the terms that the Western powers impose, because this is going to be an imposed peace. Right? The armistice terms, which are decided on in November of 1918, are such as to make it impossible for Germany to resume the military struggle. And the three Western democracies, by themselves, have a free hand to impose the sort of peace that they want. Okay. This peace that they work out, the peace of 1919, the heart of which is the Treaty of Versailles of 1919, negotiated among the three Western democracies and imposed by them on a defeated Germany, this peace of 1919 turns out to be the most unstable peace in the history of great power politics. You know, barely a decade later, it's in a shambles, and 2 decades later, a new and even more dangerous war with Germany breaks out. Right? And the central problem for us as we start to analyze the peace of 1919 and the interwar period is to try and figure out whether there's any connection between those two things. Whether it was unstable, precisely because it was imposed by the three great Western democracies and by them alone. It was the only peace settlement that the three Western democracies imposed. The peace after the Napoleonic Wars obviously did not fall in that category. The Cold War peace, not imposed by the Western democracies alone. Is there some basic about the democratic approach to foreign policy, it makes for an unstable international system. Is Kennan, in effect, right? Right? That's the question that we're going to keep in the back of our minds as we start looking at the historical record. And so next time, that's what we're going to do. We're going to look at the Treaty of Versailles, try and figure out whether this was a Wilsonian peace or not, and try and understand why it was as unstable as it was. Okay, so I'll see you next time.